You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
So what exactly are apologetics? Maybe you're familiar with this idea, maybe you're not, but apologetics, according to theologian Clark Pinnock, is a term that is derived from a Greek term apologia that was used for a defense that a person like Socrates, for instance, might make of his views and actions. The Apostle Peter tells every Christian to be ready to give a reason, again, an apologia, for the hope that is in him. Apologetics, then, is an activity of the Christian mind which attempts to show that the gospel message is true in what it affirms. The apologist is one who is prepared to defend the message against criticism and distortion and to give evidence of its credibility. In summary, apologetics is the act of presenting facts that winsomely demonstrate the credibility of God's truth. And so apologetics does have the purpose of building up the Christian, of increasing the Christian's confidence. But first and foremostly, apologetics is really about answering objections. It's about answering criticisms or questions that are being leveraged by people in the world who do not know God. And so apologetics is very closely related to evangelism. It's part of the process of gaining a hearing for God and his truth in a cynical and dismissive world. Now, as Clark Pinnock mentioned, apologetics are biblical. This is not just something that belongs to the modern era. In 1 Peter 3:15, he quoted this verse, we're told to always be able to give a defense, to be able to give a reason for the hope that we have. We also see that apologetics are used in the Bible, like in John 5, verse 46 through 47. This is just one example of where Jesus points back to the Old Testament and the prophecies that are made in the Old Testament. And he says, this is how you can know that I am who I say I am. He says, Moses wrote about me. He says, and he points back to the legacy of prophecy that is an evidential form of argument that he was, in fact, the Messiah. Acts 17, we see Paul arguing from the natural order to the Greeks, demonstrating from things that they knew to be true that there must be a creator God. And so apologetics are biblical in the sense that the biblical authors use them. They use arguments when they're presenting faith in Christ. Apologetics are also just necessary. They're something that we need for a number of different reasons. Human beings, we are many things, but we are certainly rational beings. We have minds, and God, he forms mountains, right? He can control the seas, but he chooses to reason with mankind. And in Isaiah 1:18, he actually invites people to come and reason with them. He says, let's go tit for tat. Let's go back and forth. You know, you give your reasons, I'll give mine. Let's see who's right. Apologetics are also necessary because Satan, God's adversary, is always in process of generating new lies, distortions of the truth. And so we're told to be aware of Satan's schemes and ready to stand against him as he is constantly trying to recalibrate arguments and ideas to lead people away from the truth of God. Finally, Christianity does something that really no other religion does, namely it bases itself on testable or falsifiable truth claims, which is actually part of the strength of our belief system, that it hinges itself on things that are real, things that can be tested. But part of offering testable evidence is that people can question that evidence, right? And so for this reason, throughout history, as people reject God for different reasons, and as human rebellion against God continues to morph in its script, the world continues to offer up new objections against the evidence for the truth of Christ and for the truth of the gospel message. And so what this means is that apologetics are not just necessary, they're not just biblical, but they're also contextual. They're contextual, meaning that they belong to a certain place in a certain time. They are calibrated to an audience and to the questions, the attacks that are coming. This is why when Paul spoke to the Jews, we see that he used Old Testament revelation as the very core of his argument. He took the Berean Christians through the Old Testament scriptures because they believed in the scriptures. They knew that they were true, and so he demonstrated from them that Jesus was the Messiah. When he was speaking to the Greeks, He used a different form of argument. He bases his argument on the natural order, and he also points out to the wisdom of Greek poets, the points where they were correct about things in the world, and he forms his argument for God's existence on that basis. In the modern era, in the era that you and I are really living in, on the heels of this era, scientific and European philosophical arguments came up and against in criticism of the Bible and of belief in God in a way that was new and really not experienced by previous generations of Christians. Therefore, you think of things like the cosmological argument, the teleological argument. These are sort of classical, traditional apologetics, the moral argument, the problem of evil. It's not that ancient people didn't have these issues, but the form of argument became more sophisticated as people learned more about science and as our views on philosophy began to develop. And so Christian thinkers had to rise to the occasion. We had to learn how to communicate with secular people who had lost belief in the supernatural and now were arguing from the natural order for the lack of existence of God. We can thank thinkers like Alvin Plantinga for the work that he did on the moral argument for God and the problem of evil. We can think about Francis Collins and the Human Genome Project and just the different evidence that's been gathered in support of what's called fine-tuning. It's the argument for intelligent design. Many of these arguments have been refined over the course of the last 100 or so years in response to the objections being made by the non-Christian world. And so the relevancy of an apologetic varies according to whom the apology is being given. That's a very important point. My parents minister in Phnom Penh, Cambodia, where they are missionaries, and very rarely do they find themselves arguing about science and the Bible. Why is that? Well, it's because their audience takes the supernatural for granted. And they're not very well educated. They don't know a lot about science. It doesn't mean that scientific argumentation for God and scientific apologetics aren't important. They can often be used to strengthen individual believers. But in communicating with non-Christians, they often are not very used because the audience is not asking those questions. And so the apology is varied according to whom it's being given. Eric Mason, who spoke here last year, talked about the need for a culturally contextual apologetics. He said, in this book, I'm introducing something I call urban apologetics. When I use urban and urban apologetics, I'm referring specifically to our defense of the Christian faith against black objections and how Christianity meets the unique needs and answers the unique questions of black people. We employ classical apologetic approaches when we are talking to a black atheist or agnostic, many of whom value scientific explanations over faith-based assertions. The evidential model is particularly helpful when faced with challenges like, prove to me that Jesus existed or Christianity was created in Europe. So that's an example of a culturally contextual apologetic. And it's important for us to develop these and to be evaluating the utility of the different arguments that exist for Christianity as we consider what it is the culture is saying. And so in many ways, what I'm going to be doing here this morning is very similar to Mason in the sense that I'm going to be presenting to you a culturally adjusted apologetic. I'm going to be talking about the subject of identity. Now, identity is a vast subject. In many ways, what we're going to be doing today is not going to be presenting a classical form of an apologetic. This is what some people would call a presuppositional apologetic. What that means is that it deals with the assumptions that our culture has. It points to the broken or discordant nature of those assumptions and then uses that as a basis for then arguing that God's way is better, that it makes more sense. That's the essence of a presuppositional approach. And this is really what we're going to be doing here today, using the subject of identity, something with which our culture and modern people today are obsessed, but also very, very confused. Now, I didn't make this up. This is something that is written about by other authors. People have talked about this, and I've actually stolen a lot of my content here today from Timothy Keller's book, Making Sense of God, which is an excellent book. It's one of those rare books where it's bangers only. Like, every chapter is good. There's not that many books out there like that. And a lot of the content that I'm using here today, if you would like an expanded version of this content, you should go back and look at chapter 6 called The Problem of Self. And you should also look at chapter 7, which is called An Identity That Doesn't Crush You or Exclude Other People. That's That's a lot of this content has been mined from those chapters. I'm just making it presentable and accessible to you here today. And so we're not going to be presenting today some sort of formula. I'm not going to be giving you a step-by-step argument to roll out in a public debate with an atheist. That's not the point. What I am hoping to do is to equip you with information and understanding about what our culture thinks about identity. I want to fill out your understanding of what identity is and then demonstrate how the biblical approach to identity is more secure and more rational. It's something which makes more sense. I hope that as you navigate spiritual conversations in the weeks, the months, the years to come, that having some of this information will equip you to lead those conversations in a spiritually productive direction. You'll be able to make some of these points and ultimately make an argument, make a case for the credibility of the Christian faith through it. And so that's what we're aiming at today. Now, with that being said, I will give you some practical ideas for starting a conversation on the topic of identity, because so often, isn't that the problem? We just don't know how to begin these types of discussions. And here's a couple conversation starters, some openers that you could potentially use to get into this topic. What makes you who you are? You know, you probably shouldn't blindside the guy at Waffle House with this question. But, you know, if you have a relationship with somebody and you're sitting there and you're talking, then, you know, maybe you could, this is the kind of thing you could bring up. You know, what do you think about that? Or what should people base their identity on? With maybe somebody that you've learned some things about, you could say, it seems that you really draw your sense of self from blank. Have you ever thought about what you would do if that just went away? It's a good question. I think a lot of people with whom you have a trust relationship would be willing to dialogue about something like that. And this can easily lead to talking about God, faith, and the Bible. And that's really the point here. Another topic that many of us try to avoid that can easily lead to this type of discussion are questions about gender identity and sexual orientation. They lead naturally to discussions about the nature of identity. Why is that? Well, really, before you can talk about sex and gender, we have to talk about identity. A friend of mine just recently, he was talking to a friend of his at work, and the friend began to criticize and bring up the biblical view of sexuality. And my friend responded in a way that was very savvy. He said, you know, I'd love to talk to you about that subject. He said, however, the point of departure in our worldviews goes way further back than just sex or gender. He says, it really begins with the question of identity. You know, how do we know who we are? What is a human being? He says, so before we can even really talk about this, I feel like we need to talk about this first. And that was a good pivot. The person was like, okay, that makes sense. And they had a great conversation that then laid a reasonable foundation for talking about the moral quandary for our culture, which is that of gender and sexuality. And so even something like this, this topic can be extremely useful if we're well-equipped. So let's move into it. Let's talk about identity. How do we define identity? Well, sociologists have traditionally defined identity as having two different parts. The first part is what we call a sense of self. A sense of self is the thing that is true of you. It's the fixed thing that is true of you in every single setting of life. Most of us, we wear masks in different settings. We're one person at work. We're one person with our families. We might be a completely different person with one group of friends. We often have hidden aspects of ourselves. But what's always true? What's always true of you, no matter where you are, that is a person's sense of self. The second part is your sense of worth. And so this is not just your sense of who you are, but it's the value or significance of who you are. It's how you determine whether those parts of you are worth something. Are they significant? Are they, you know, I like cheeseburgers. That might be one aspect of who I am, but how is that weighed against the fact that I'm an American or something potentially more significant? That's the sense of worth. And so this is not just what changes, what never changes, but it's what matters most about you and why. So a sense of self and a sense of worth. And this is something, this topic of trying to determine your sense of self and your sense of worth is a highly consequential pursuit. It's something which matters more than most things that people think about. Why is that? Well, for one thing, it's sort of the universal human quest. Every culture and every person is attempting to answer this question on a societal level and on an individual level as well. How people conceive of their identity, how they evaluate themselves, really changes the course of an entire life. You know, you often live out who you think you are. That's the fact. Also, we are drawn to people who seem to know who they are. There's something about someone who is secure and confident in who they are that is deeply attractive. I mean, it's the kind of thing you might want to date that person. At minimum, you might want to listen to that person because they seem to have it figured out. Finally, and very relevant to the Christian, is the fact that cultural pressure has a large effect on the way that we define ourselves, a much greater effect than we would often like to admit. That's something we'll talk about a little bit more later. But believers, we're supposed to have an examined worldview. We're supposed to have a worldview that is not just one that we've inherited or received from the world around us, but we're supposed to have something which is weighed against the truth of Scripture. And so we need to understand the dynamics that our culture and the pressure that it exerts plays in the way that we conceive of ourselves. And so there have been two ways throughout the course of human history. And I grant that this is probably an oversimplification. We could talk about this in much more specific terms. But in general, there are two ways that people have conceived of identity. The first of these approaches is what we can call a traditional approach to identity. The traditional approach states that I am what my family or my community needs me to be. The traditional approach looks outside. It looks without to determine self. And this was very common in the ancient world. In fact, it's still prevalent in many non-Western cultures today. This is still how people develop that sense of self. It's still how they develop that sense of worth. The emphasis in a traditional society is not on just my feelings, but it's my duties towards other people. In traditional societies, the values are things like honor and commitment. The hero in these types of cultures is the self-sacrificing member, the person who is willing to give it all for blood and for country. That's the hero. We can still see vestiges of this kind of thinking in American war movies. Like if you think of like Saving Private Ryan, Braveheart, it's really the last place where this sort of view makes any sense. It's the last place where in our society people seem to express this idea, but it's not very common today. The script of the traditional society is this, or the traditional approach to identity is this. You are your duties and your self-worth. And your self-worth depends on the honor that is bestowed upon you by your community for discharging those duties. That's the script. Okay, so that's the traditional approach. On the polar opposite side of the spectrum, we have the modern approach to identity. And these two things cannot be more different from one another. And that's because in many ways, modern identity formation is a reaction to traditional identity formation. The modern mantra, so to speak, is I am whatever I make myself to be. It's a view of identity that requires self-generation and self-description. And this is us, right? This is Western culture. This is pervasive in our society. The emphasis for the modern approach is on personal goal advancement. It's not on the needs of others. It's on personal goal advancement. The values are fulfillment and pleasure, your own fulfillment and pleasure. Those are the most important things. Everything else is accessory, according to this view. And the hero, rather than being the self-sacrificing member, who now actually is viewed as an unhealthy person, that's an unhealthy person who's controlled by others. Now the hero is the self-asserting individual instead. And we can find this view. We can find this script being spoken. It's hanging behind the words of every pop song. It's in every movie. It's in every TV show. It really animates almost everything that our culture produces. She's a cheap and easy example, but Elsa from Frozen is probably the best example of this. It's the no right, no wrong, no rules for me, I'm free, right? It's the escaping of you know, the bonds of tradition and where I've come from and who I'm expected to be. It's the authenticity is found in throwing those things back and then walking into my own personal concept of who I am. That is modern identity. And so the script is, you are your individual dreams and desires. Who are you? You are your dreams, you are your desires, and your self-worth depends on the dignity that you bestow on yourself apart from other people. That's very important. If it's not apart from others, it's not authentic, not according to this view. It must be in isolation to be real. So obviously, we're going to be spending time this morning assessing modern identity. That's kind of why we're here, right? But before we do that, we need to acknowledge that the modern approach does actually have a lot of positives. Conservative thinkers have a way sometimes of glorifying traditional identity as if it's like this great thing that is like, that's the way it was in the Bible, right? But in fact, traditional identity has major problems as well. For instance, traditional societies were rigid and controlling. They often confined people to caste systems. None of us should be mourning the death of the European feudal system, right? I mean, if you were born in France in the 1700s and your father was a shoemaker, guess what you were? You were a shoemaker. That even might be why your name is literally shoemaker, right? And that was, you know, people had very few choices. In some societies, there was even, you know, this was based on racism. People were confined to socioeconomic classes. You know, there was no room for creativity. And so the traditional approach to identity actually denies much of what it truly means to be a human being. And this is a problem. I, for one, am really glad that our society is not purely traditional anymore in its approach to identity. I come from three generations of American football players. My grandfather, my uncles, and my father all played college football, and some of them coached on a college level. Then here I am born. I'm lanky. I weighed 130 pounds but was 6 foot until I was 18. I would have been broken over someone's knee. I'm so thankful that I didn't have to play American football, right? And so we should be glad about this change. More importantly, Scripture affirms both individuality and freedom. These are actually very important things. In Psalm 139, it says that we've been created uniquely by God, that we're fearfully and wonderfully made, that there's a sense in which when God makes a person, you are one of a kind. There's no one else like you in the entire world that has ever existed. You are something so special and so unique in God's eyes, and that is a critical part of understanding who we are as human beings. In Luke 4, we understand that when Jesus came to this world, a big part of why he came was to liberate the captives. He doesn't want people to be controlled. Oppression is evil. Oppression is bad. Being told just to get back in line and obey is not God's way. Well, 1 Peter 4:11 also says that as spiritual creatures, God has given us gifts. And each of us are in a real sense, not just biologically unique, but we are spiritually unique as well. We've been made to serve God and worship him in ways that are distinct as well. And so this is an important aspect of who we are. Traditional approaches to identity forget this. They deny this in many cases. And so the modern approach has real strengths in the sense that it has recaptured elements of something that is true from the Bible, and it is there in the mind of God. But with that being said, the modern approach to identity also has terminal problems. It has long since left some of its half-biblical inspiration and become something very different. Let's talk about those problems now. First of all, basing your identity on your desires is illogical. It doesn't make sense to base your identity, to decide who you are, on the basis of your desires. Why is that? Well, for one thing, desires are deeply contradictory. We often want things that are mutually exclusive. We want love. We want love, but we also want control and comfort. You often can't have all three at the same time. Love messes up comfort. It breaks control. When you try to have control and love at the same time, it becomes not love. And so our desires are often contradictory. Francis Spufford, a British author, says, "You are a being whose wants make no sense. They don't harmonize, whose desires deep down are discordantly arranged, so that you truly want to possess and you truly want not to at the very same time. You're equipped for farce and even tragedy more than you are for happy endings." Kind of dark. But there's truth to that. There's truth to that. This is one reason why it's so tragic when modern people are like, okay, who am I? Who am I? I just got to figure out what I want. You want different things. You want mutually exclusive things. And therefore, it's hard to look inside to figure that out. Desires are also elusive. Peter Greer last night talked about the way in which When people seek to achieve, and then they do achieve, often they end up disappointed. He quoted Tom Brady after 7 Super Bowl rings, but you know, it's often quoted, but he said the same thing when he won 3 Super Bowl rings. He found himself wondering, what else is there? Is this really all there is? You know, even when you achieve, even when you get the fulfillment of the desire, your rap career takes off, like, you know, whatever it might be. Like, even when you get the fulfillment of the desire, those people always end up feeling kind of shortchanged, kind of empty-handed, because that's not, at the end of the day, who you really are. And finally, desires are also constantly changing. A lot of people in the audience can probably relate. I wanted some things when I was 18. I'm 35 now, and I want very different things. When I'm 55, I'll probably want even different things, right? And so what we want out of life, what we want for ourselves, is also an evolving state. It's not something fixed. It's not a secure sense of self in that sense. A second terminal problem with the modern approach to identity is that to establish your identity apart from others, totally apart from other people, is impossible. You just can't do it. Why is this? Because we are hopelessly interconnected. We are relational beings at the very core. It's part of the way that we were made. We can deny this. We can try to live as hermits, but it is the way that human beings are structured. And so even the most independently minded people among us do require some kind of external source of validation. It's true. You dig deep enough and you'll find it. You'll find that each person needs this. They might not be finding it in a live community. They might find it on an internet forum. They might find it in an author, in a book of some kind, but they require external validation to develop a sense of self. Tim Keller puts it like this. He says, to use biblical terms, we need someone to bless us because we can't bless ourselves. We are irreducibly social and relational beings. We need someone to respect, to respect us. And we need someone we admire to admire us. Even when modern people claim to be validating themselves, the reality is always that they are socializing themselves into a new community of peers, of cheerleaders, of people whose approval they crave. That's absolutely true. Finally, we are all influenced by the cultural grid that is handed to us much more than we would like to admit. And this is true of everybody. It's true of you and I. It's true of people throughout all of human history, that our grid, our cultural grid, is the thing that more significantly helps us sort our internal components more than anything else. Let me give you a thought experiment. I want you to consider 2 different men, separated by time and space, but shockingly similar. We've got Rothgar and we've got Todd, okay? Now, Rothgar and Todd are very different in very obvious ways. However, they're very similar in certain internal ways. For instance, both Rothgar and Todd experience strong inclinations towards violence. They both feel strongly the desire to take out their aggression by hurting other people. Rothgar looks at this aspect. He looks inside and says, "That is who I am." And his culture applauds him for it. His friends and family agree. They say, "Yes, that is who you are. Absolutely." Todd, on the other hand, goes to therapy, right? He can't possibly accept that as who he is. That's something discordant. It doesn't belong. It has to be dealt with. And his therapist and his friends and family, they agree too. Like, Todd, that's not you, right? On the other hand, though, Rothgar and Todd also have something else in common. Rothgar and Todd both experience sexual attraction to other men. Rothgar looks at that part of who he he looks inside. He considers that part of what he sees, and he says, "That is not who I am." He says, that is not who I am, and his friends and family agree, right? He's like, it doesn't belong. This is something which, out of all the different competing desires in my heart, he says, this is one that I'm going to move away from. Well, Todd, on the other hand, will most likely embrace that as a core component of his identity. And so what we see is that the mere presence of something inside of you is an inappropriate basis for saying, this is who I am. Because it's actually your cultural grid, if anything, that causes you to look inside and sort those different things and decide what matters most. What do I suppress and what do I cultivate? Every culture will answer that question differently with different types of internal components. And that's really what this illustrates. Robert Bella, the famed American sociologist, says that the irony here is that just where we modern people think that we are the most free, we are most coerced by the dominant beliefs of our own culture. For it is a powerful cultural fiction that we not only can but must make up our deepest beliefs in the isolation of our private selves. We never get to the bottom of ourselves on our own, he says. We discover who we are face to face and side by side with others in work, love, and learning. Yeah, it's really true. A third issue with the modern approach to identity is that when we try to forge an identity this way, it's also overwhelming. An achievement-based identity is overwhelming. Again, Conrad and Peter Greer talked about this last night too. This kind of approach requires constant maintenance. It's not enough to win. You got to keep winning. It's not enough to, you know, to draw something beautiful. It's like you better create something new, right? And so what this ends up doing is putting undue weight on things like career, hobbies, our relationships. These things become ultimate things in which we need not just success, but continued success if we're going to be worth something in our own eyes and in the eyes of other people. A really excellent documentary that gets at this is called The Weight of Gold. It was actually produced by Michael Phelps, but it includes contributions from like Apollo Ono and all these, the kind of the who's who of Olympic gold medalists throughout the course of the last 50 years. And here's the thing about this documentary is that it's got like a chilling analysis with no solution, which is kind of the worst type of documentary because you like watch it and you're like, what are we going to do about it? And they're like, we should talk more about it, right? It's like a podcast. It's like every podcast is like, it's really good we're having this conversation, right? That's like, but the thing is Olympic gold medalists almost universally are plagued by mental health issues. They are depressed. They are despondent. And after they get the gold, their lives usually fall apart. And this documentary demonstrates that. And so that's what happens when we make something that is meant to be adjacent to something that is ultimate. It puts undue weight on career, hobbies, and also our relationships. What happens when your marriage falls apart? Do you lose who you are? Or are you something beneath that? Keller puts it like this. He says, you've got to be brilliant. You've got to be beautiful. You've got to be hip. And you've got to be accomplished. And they have to think so. It's all up to you in a way that in traditional cultures, it just wasn't the case. It's well said. Final critique. Forming an identity this way also leaves us divided. It leaves us divided. It leaves us without the ability to create real, lasting community. You see, when you have this radically individualistic approach to self, relationships are really just a means to an end. I mean, you should not be a part of a community unless it furthers your personal goals, unless it enhances your ability to achieve your desires, because that's what matters the most. We only stick to the people then who further our goals. Keller says that human communities become thinned out into lifestyle enclaves or social networks in which people connect flexibly and transiently only to people like themselves. They relate to one another around similar tastes in music or food or common wealth status, but their private and their public lives are no one else's business. It is well documented that under the conditions of the modern individualistic self, social ties and institutions are eroding, marriage and family are weakening, society is fragmenting into warring factions, and economic inequality is growing. So much for the rugged American dream. What this approach to identity is achieving is fragmentation. It's not capable of producing unity. And so that is a devastating critique, in my opinion, of the way that pretty much everyone we know thinks about themselves. I think people need to hear that. I think people in a compassionate way need to interact with this argument, because think about it. They're living their lives. People live their lives. Some of us here today might even be, you know, we're influenced by this. So we might be living our lives with the expectation that somehow this is going to lead to fulfillment and desire. We're going to keep wondering, why aren't my relationships working? Why do I have to like refind myself every 5 years and dig around and come up with something new only to have that crumble in my hands? What an enslavement. What a discordant way to live. Thank God there's something better. Thank God that we can have a better basis for understanding self. Yeah, so the traditional approach is to say, you got to look outside. You got to look horizontal to figure out who you are. The modern approach says, no, 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 look inside. Look inside. The answers are within. But there is a third option, and this is where we bring in God's truth to weigh on the situation. Because we don't have to just look out and in, we can also look up. We can look up to someone, to a being that has authoritative perspective to determine what it means to be a human being and to assign both significance and value. And that is freedom. That is what brings freedom. It's what brings the real thing that our culture is looking for. Keller says, what if we were created by a personal God and given a personal mission and calling? Then neither does the individual take precedence over the group, ultimately driving people apart, nor does the community take precedence over the individual, which can lead to oppression. What matters is not what society says about me, nor what I think about myself, but what God does. That's right. The divine approach, the God-centered approach to identity, formation, begins with the thought that I am, first and foremost, who I am before God. That's who I am. It's not that there's not other significant elements of identity. I'm a father. It's an important part of who you are, but that's not at the core who you are, because, you know, your kids, they could grow up and leave you. They could die. You know, we can lose those things, right? But I am, first and foremost, who I am before God. This means that I am both valuable and unique as an individual. That's affirmed. God made me for freedom. God made me to be who I am and different than you. However, I remain interconnected and responsible to others without having to be determined or controlled by others. And that's an important distinction. I like how Paul puts it in 1 Corinthians 4, 3 through 4. He says, I care very little if I'm judged by you or any human court. He says, and indeed, I don't even judge myself. He says, my conscience is clear, but that does not make me innocent. He says, because it is the Lord who judges me. And that sort of perspective gives him the ability then to enter into relationships with confidence, but also with love. He can give in a relationship when he views himself this way. You see, the emphasis in the God-centered approach is God and his gifts. That's where the whole thing begins. We see everything else in the light of God and his gifts. We value relationships and we value truth because those things are unchanging and they come directly from God. The hero here is not just the person who sacrifices himself for the others. We don't look for a martyr. We don't look for you know someone to show us the way out. But instead, we look to Jesus Christ. He's the only true hero of this particular story, and we are free then to model ourselves after him. And so, what God is offering to people, what God is offering to you, what God is offering to me, what he's offering to people who don't know who they are, is he's offering an identity that is received rather than an identity that is achieved. This begins with the fact of creation. The basic thing that's true about a human being is that we've been made in the image of God. Physically speaking, we have an identity in the sheer fact of our creation. But also, we have identity in our spiritual recreation as well. In Ephesians 2, 8, and 9, it's through the grace and mercy of God through Jesus Christ that we've been made new. We've been made new, and it's not of ourselves. It's a gift of God. It's something which is received. It can't be self-generated. It's an identity that is fixed. We can't do anything to earn it. It's not achievement-based. It is something which is conferred by God, and therefore it's secure. He also offers an identity that provides a new source of motivation. In Colossians 3, it says that whatever you do, you can do anything. Whatever you do, he says, do everything in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God, the Father, through him. And so the motivator of the Christian life becomes the acceptance that we receive from God, and we express our gratitude through serving him and through serving other people. What this means is if my achievements fall short, you know, if I don't get to be a doctor and I end up digging ditches instead, happiness and fulfillment can still be found for a person even when my ambitions are disappointed. When we're not accepted the way that we thought we would be, when we're chronically misunderstood, if you never get a single social media like ever again, guess what? It doesn't matter. Not ultimately. I mean, it might hurt your feelings. You should talk to your friend if, like, if they don't like you or something. But in the ultimate sense, it does not matter, because who you are at the core is something which is unassailable when it begins with God. Keller says, ordinary moralistic religion operates on this principle. I live a good moral life, therefore God accepts me. But gospel Christianity operates in the opposite way. It says that God accepts me unconditionally in Jesus Christ, and therefore I live a good and moral life. In the first case, you live a good life out of the hope of reward, with all the insecurity and self-doubts that go with it. But in the Christian approach, the real Christian approach, the motivation is one not of fear, but of grateful joy. You serve him not in order to coerce him and to love you, but because he already does. Yeah. God also offers us an identity that gives a secure sense of worth. Romans 8, Paul says, listen, nothing, he says. Not angels, nor demons, death, nor life, present, nor future, powers, height, depth, nothing in all of creation can separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus our Lord. We have this eternal hanging fact. In 1 John it says, God has lavished his love upon us so that we are, not that we can be, not that we will be, not that we could be, but that we are children of God as a fixed and eternal truth. He also gives us an identity that gives wisdom in knowing how to live. Modern people have to dig inside of themselves. You know, they might read a book. They might read a book. They might talk to a friend. But it's all really, the purpose of anything external in the modern sense is to sort of just bounce it off the soul and see if you can find something real, right? To gain inspiration. It's the inspiration of self that's authoritative. But God gives real wisdom. God gives us actual answers to the way that life is supposed to be lived. His desire for us is that we live a life that's worthy of him, that we please him, and that we bear fruit, that we be abundant in our lives, growing in the knowledge of God. And if you don't have wisdom, if you don't know what to do, he says, that's okay. You can ask me because you have full access to me. He says, I will give generously to you without reproach. What an incredible security. What a gift, man, to be able to consult the God of the universe. And to know that he will listen and that he will speak to you. It's incredible. May every person have that confidence. One final point. God is offering an identity that makes real and loving community possible. It's funny because even though our culture is all about personal goal fulfillment, people love to talk about community. People love to say, you know, we're all about community here, you know? Like even like restaurants or like Starbucks is like, we're a community. No, they're not, you know? The things that our culture calls community fall short. It's not really community. But an identity that comes from God makes real loving community possible. In Galatians 5, we're reminded of the fact that we have freedom. It's actually amazing. God doesn't control us. He actually empowers us. He's like, hey, here's a sense of self-worth. Here's spiritual gifts. Here's oftentimes supportive relationships. Here's, just completely being off the hook, like the gun's off the table, like you're forgiven. Here's all of that. Be free, right? Anything else that you would, like, you don't need to find those things. You have it. Go live. Then he says, but if you want to really live, he says, then use that freedom to serve other people. You know, limit yourself voluntarily for the sake of others, he says, and then together you'll find out what life is really supposed to be like. Romans 12:5, we're told that we are connected spiritually through Jesus Christ. And so that ultimate point of connection transcends all superficial points of connection. You belong to a different political party. That is, at best, tertiary to belonging to Jesus Christ. And that becomes the most important thing. And that becomes a basis for unity that outstrips every other cultural factor. One final quote here from Tim Keller. He says, one of the most unique things about Christianity is that it is truly a worldwide religion. Over 90% of Muslims live in a band from Southeast Asia to the Middle East and North Africa. Over 95% of all Hindus are in India and immediate environs. And some 88% of Buddhists are in East Asia. However, 25% of Christians live in Europe. 25% in Central Asia and South America, 22% in Africa, 15% and growing fast in Asia, and 12% in North America. Almost certainly, Christianity exhibits more cultural diversity than any other religion, and that must say something about it. What makes Christianity less culturally imperialistic than many of the other great worldviews? The crucial reason is that Christians are saved by grace alone. They do not enter their salvation by obedience to moral law, nor do they keep themselves saved that way. The New Testament has no detailed set of laws and rules about behavior that tend to remove its adherents from their cultures. The Christian who makes Christ his love and his love the core of his or her identity then discovers that we need not completely reject other identity factors. You can remain an individual. You can remain wherever you've come from. Our race, national identity, our work, our profession, our family, politics, community, it can all remain intact. They are no longer the ultimate basis for our significance and security, but that does not mean they are flattened or eliminated. Instead, we're free to enjoy them as we were meant to. We can enjoy them as gifts, as elements of life, but not the main thing. If anything else is elevated, it becomes a basis for division. It leads to fragmentation. But through God, in Jesus Christ, we have a basis for unity with every type of person. And that's why we have the possibility, the power to form loving communities in a way that no one else in this world can. And so that's another fruit of what it means to have this type of basis for knowing who we are. Let me just share a few final thoughts, then we'll be done for this morning. Identity is at the epicenter of our cultural crisis. It really is. I mean, you think of everything that's happening in the world. You think of all the anger, of all the confusion. Identity is somewhere near the very core. People are screaming on social media, not ultimately at each other. They're just expressing out because there's this confusion, this frustration of, who am I? I thought I was this. I thought that I knew these things about the world and about myself, and all of my paradigms are being broken. And a lot of it comes down to identity. Only God's truth supplies a satisfying answer to people's confusion. God has the answer on this. We have to think about how we're going to bring people that answer in a way that they can understand. I think what we've done here today is outline some points that could help with that. Maybe an approach that could be meaningful as you're talking to your friends and to your family. We need to be able to speak persuasively. That's important, but we also have to be able to model confidence and security. This is part of the unspoken witness that we have in this moment. It's not just to be loving people. We often talk about how Christians should be loving, and that's part of our witness to the world, but we should also be confident. We should be secure. Mark Sayers, an Australian author that I really like, has this book called A Non-Anxious Presence. And his argument in that book is that the most important leadership quality in today's climate is to be non-anxious. It's to be confident and to be secure, to not be reactive to the people around you. He said, those are the people that people are going to look at and be like, what do you know that I don't? Those are the people that are going to be attractive to people in this world. And so part of the fruit of us understanding this is not just our ability to express it, but it's our ability to live it as well. And if we live it, we're going to win a hearing from people because they're going to want to know, you know, how can you have such a stable sense of self, such a stable sense of worth when the world is the way that it is? And thank God you have an answer. That is all we have from on identity as an apologetic. Thanks for coming to the workshop.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.